We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus from Illinois Public Media, our morning talk program. In for David Inge, I'm Tom Rogers. In the first hour on Focus this morning, we have our monthly visit from David Sinnoh, and he'll answer your questions this morning about personal finance. David Sinnoh is the clinical professor of finance in the College of Business and the director of the Office of Risk Management and Insurance Research at the University of Illinois. And he stops by once a month for the express purpose of answering your questions and giving you some updates on the world of personal finance. If you have questions for David Sinnoh, you can give us a call at 333-9455 or the toll-free line, of course, 1-800-222-9455. And we say again, good morning, David.
Well, good morning, Tom. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I'd like to begin this morning with an overview of the real estate market, as documented yesterday by Derek Kravitz of the Associated Press. I'm going to quote from some of the information in his article and then discuss a widely used technique by individuals who want to help out children and grandchildren with reference to financing a purchase of a residential real estate property or, in the alternative, an income property. Well, it's no secret that fewer people purchased homes in April than obviously the month before. Sales of previously occupied homes, in fact, fell 0.8% in April to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of about 5 million units. Now, that's according to the National Association of Realtors. And that, of course, is far below the 6 to 6.5 million units that represents what we would call a rather healthy market. Since the housing boom went bust, sales have fallen in 4 of the past 5 years. Hit a 13-year low last year, and of course, that's been accompanied by sharp declines. And not only sharp declines in housing prices, but sharp declines in mortgage rates as well. Now, some people who want to buy can't, mostly because banks have tightened lending requirements and are insisting on much larger down payments. In the old days, it was 100% financing, perhaps 1 to 5% down. And now, really, to qualify for those loans, you're talking typically a minimum of a 20% down payment. That at least represents conventional financing. And many buyers who are able to qualify for loans are actually holding off, worried that home prices really haven't hit bottom yet. And when we compare the condominium market to the actual residential market, in most areas of the country, the condominium townhouse market has actually been hit harder than the residential market. And more homes under contract for sale are actually being, well, they're being delayed. They're being renegotiated. They're even being canceled, mostly because of these tighter lending requirements. In fact, in a recent survey by the Association of Realtors, 11% of their realtors said a contract was canceled because an appraisal came in below the negotiated price, and 14% said a contract was renegotiated to a lower price because of a low appraisal. The median sales price in April of a home in the U.S. was about $160,000 to $165,000. That's still down about 5% from the same time just a year ago. And the median price of a new home, which is very interesting, is actually about 30 to 35% higher than a used home with similar square footage. And that's twice the usual markup or twice the usual spread. A lot of that, of course, is due to the foreclosure crisis. Okay, sales of homes at risk of foreclosure actually fell in April. That's a good sign, but still made up about 37% of all purchases. Foreclosure sales declined only because a very large number of foreclosed homes are actually backlogged in the courts. They've been held up by the state, the federal probes. You've heard about the robo-signings. So we still have very, very troubled foreclosure lenders. And actually, a record of about 1 million homes, just a terrible number, were lost to foreclosures in 2010. And very prominent sources such as RealtyTrack are suggesting that maybe as much as 1.2 million, maybe more, will be foreclosed and lost this year. It's just a terrible strategy, a terrible statistic indeed. While there's a glut of unsold homes on the market, few buyers, as we know, are biting. In April, the supply of homes rose to nearly 4 million. And at that current sales price, it would take more than 9 months to clear these homes. The situation is much worse when taking into account shadow inventory. That's what the economists tell us, that there are many, many homes in various stages of foreclosure, but because of the courts, because banks don't want to put these on the market, there are just lots and lots of homes waiting to be placed on the market for resale, and that could further exacerbate prices. The Mortgage Bankers Association said Monday that more than 8% of all current homeowners with a mortgage missed at least one mortgage payment in the first quarter of 2011. And that's up almost 1% from the previous quarter. And sales, interestingly enough, fell in almost all regions of the country. In April, sales declined some 7.5% in the Northeast. They declined almost 2% in the West. They declined in the South. And interestingly enough, about the only place that sales actually rose was in our good old-fashioned Midwest. Well, clearly prices are down. Mortgage rates are very reasonable. I visited with several mortgage bankers this morning. They tell me that 15-year rates are about 4.25, 30-year rates 4.75, again approaching historic lows. And at the same time, as we know, money market rates, CD rates, well, they're just bloody abysmal. If you're in a money market account, maybe you're paying the money market to hold your money. I'm not sure, but it's very, very slim indeed, maybe 0.05% on an annualized basis. But recently, a growing number of retired individuals are actually now loaning their money. They're not leaving it in their money market accounts. They're loaning their money to their children, or indeed in some cases, to their grandchildren to buy a home. Essentially, these individuals are acting as the mortgage bank. So no longer are we going to the mortgage bank, we're going to grandma and grandpa, or maybe we're going to mom and dad, and they are becoming the principal lender, lending as much as 80-85% of the purchase price at a special interest rate. And the special interest rate that is being used is something called the applicable federal rate. That's an IRS-approved rate. In other words, there's a minimum rate that IRS says, look, when you've got a related party and you're loaning money to a related party, in order to avoid what we would call phantom income on that money, you've got to have at least a reasonable rate. So, for example, if you were going to loan money for, say, 10 years, maybe 15 years, that's called the long-term applicable federal rate, and that is a rate of 4.2%. on an annualized basis. So that's below the mortgage lender's 15-year rate. You avoid all of the closing costs, with the exception of seller, of course, providing you with a deed, a title policy, so you do have clear title. But it's a pretty good deal for mom and dad, a pretty good deal for grandma and grandpa, because suddenly their money market is now earning themselves 4 to 4.5%. It's a great deal for a child because the child doesn't have to go through all kinds of qualification. The child doesn't have lots and lots of closing costs. And they're getting a rate which is just fantastic, a rate of around 4.2% for long-term financing. Now, there's some caveats here. You've got to be careful. And if you decide to extend a loan to a child, for example, or a grandchild, I insist that you consult with an attorney and be certain to have that attorney prepare a promissory note and a mortgage instrument, both of which will look just about the same as a promissory note that you would sign and a mortgage instrument that you would sign that was prepared by a financial institution. This is serious. You have to make certain that your child, your grandchild, understands this is serious, that there are ramifications for not paying that monthly payment back. So, again, lots of people are doing this, but again, you've got to be very careful. It has to be sensibly figured out, and you have to have the appropriate paperwork. All right, let's talk about the Couch Potato portfolio. Each month we examine it, and of course you can access it on the WILL website. Now, through yesterday's close, the Couch Potato portfolio is ahead for the year approximately 7%. Not bad, but interestingly enough, if we look at our benchmark S&P 500, that's actually up a little more than 7%. Including dividends, that benchmark is up about 7.5% for the year. So this is the first time in 2011 where the diversified portfolio actually is trailing our benchmark by about 0.5%. And there's a very clear reason for that, and that is that thus far, U.S. stocks are outperforming their global counterparts, especially the emerging markets index. We heard how hot that index has been over the last 18, 24 months, last 2 years. Well, interestingly enough, through last night's close, emerging markets is basically delta neutral. It's zero for the year. It hasn't made money. It hasn't lost money. And if you'll recall that we made a strategic move at the beginning of the year, we reduced our emerging markets exposure to 2.5%. We're using the Vanguard Emerging Markets Index. So as a result of because of European positions, you mentioned, Tom, off the air a little bit about the IMF.
Right.
You mentioned a little bit off the air of some of the issues that are facing Europe. Well, their stock market is underperforming as compared to the U.S. stock market. And as a result, the good old-fashioned just benchmark S&P 500 is doing just a little bit better than our diversified portfolio. So we'll have to stay tuned to see how that all ends up. So there you have it, Tom. I'd be delighted to answer questions based on some of the issues that I've raised or tackle the questions from a very, very sophisticated listening audience at WILL.
And we've had people in our audience who can throw some very interesting and broad-based questions, very non-traditional questions. Anything for David Sinnoh is welcome, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And you can give us a call at any time during the 10 o'clock hour focus. The earlier the better, because it's harder to get those questions in when there's a limited amount of time and more people calling in.
Okay. I want to talk also very, very briefly about facing the purchase decision on a piece of real estate with respect. Does it make sense, especially for younger people, to purchase condominiums or to purchase a residential home?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can tell you that historically, residential homes have upheld their value, have maintained their value better than condominiums.
And we saw this with the housing market collapse a little bit. The condominiums really got hurt.
Really tanked,
yeah.
No question about it. So in terms of residential housing tanked less than the condominium market. There's a lot of reasons for that, and we can go into those. I see we've got callers on the line, so maybe we'll jump into those callers, and I'll come back to some of those reasons.
Or we could have a condo question coming up. Who knows? 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. We'll go to line four and caller in Des Plaines this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. I wondered, I'm trying to get a sense of a home which we're about to put up for sale. I've gotten some information concerning what's a reasonable price from the realtors, but forewarned that it may very well be a situation where the price would be lowered at a down the road. Was wondering whether or not it made sense, therefore, to increase the attractiveness of the house and the price by perhaps reducing it by 3 to 5% below what the seems to be the going price. Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, I have a number of opinions. First of all, in terms of evaluation of a home, I think it makes sense to have at least three different opinions. That's number one. Number two, homes that are selling are broom clean. They are move-in. They are very, very high quality. There is literally nothing that a buyer can complain about. So I would rather than reduce the price 3 to 5% below what you believe to be the market, I would be more concerned that that house is spick and span, has great curb appeal, and what buyers today are looking at is why shouldn't I buy this house? What's wrong with this house? So as opposed to saying, this is a great house, I love the house, they're saying, oh my, what can I find wrong with the house? So you're really facing psychological barriers with houses today and buyers today. So you want that house to just sparkle. That's the most important thing that you can do with the house. Now, I'm not suggesting that you spend thousands and thousands of dollars remodeling the house. Don't do that.
But, of course, if the buyer thinks it's a buyer's market, then, of course, they're going to be picky.
They're going to be very, very picky. So I'm certain that if you have a quality realtor, the realtor has probably made some suggestions of what should be done in terms of putting that house on the market. Because, very frankly, the most important period of time are the first 2 weeks when you put that house on the market. That's when it's going to have the most activity, and that's when it's going to have the most buyers looking at it, and you want to have that house in very, very decent shape so that you have the best opportunity of selling it. Also, I presume that you have been online and you have looked, or your realtor has looked, at actual prices of sale, not what the houses are listed at, but what they have actually sold at, similar houses to your home in the same neighborhood.
Yes.
And your realtor should be able to do that for you. I presume the realtor has already done that. Something else that often I recommend, and that is to do your own home inspection, right? Most offers today on residential homes are conditional on a home inspection at buyer's expense. And then buyer, in buyer's sole subjective judgment, based upon that inspection, can say, gee, I don't like the inspection. I'm going to walk away. I think it makes more sense for the seller to spend a couple of $100, get a licensed inspection service, and find out ahead of time if there are any substantial issues with the home.
Okay.
That would be my view of it. And then the downside of that, of course, is that you are put on notice that you might have some type of issue, and then under the rules of disclosure, you would be required to disclose that to your buyer.
Or fix them up.
Or, in the alternative, obviously, just fix it, which in either case is going to have to happen. So I always like to know ahead of time about issues with the house. I don't like to find them out after I put the house on the market, after I've got an offer, and suddenly someone comes in and says there are 1,100 things wrong with your house that yeah. need to be fixed. Most of those things are typically very, very minor and might not even involve any real expense to fix them. But if there is something structural, something that may be structural, I like to know about that ahead of time.
Yeah, I could see the wisdom of that, doctor, and I think anyone who's selling probably it's in their best interest to do so. Well, I've got my question, and unless I think of something else and during the broadcast, I'll let you get back to your other listeners, and I thank you very much.
And we thank you for your call.
Okay, bye. 333-9455,
1-800-222-9455. Yeah, you mentioned that when it is a buyer's market, you're going to have a lot more competition and a lot of buyers who have seen a lot of houses and at least feel that they have the ability to choose, to pick and choose, because there's always going to be 10 of them down the block.
No question about it. No question about it. So as a result, you really have to have that house just in spectacular shape.
You mentioned looking at the price that neighboring houses have sold for. Now, there are some tools to do that online, correct?
Absolutely.
There's something called Zillow that I've seen before. Does that serve that purpose, or is that talking only about appraised or listing prices and that sort of thing?
That particular website tracks same houses mm-hmm. in neighborhoods that have sold more than once. So they are actually tracking houses on an individual basis and following that house to get a sense of what is happening in a given market.
With selling prices.
Yeah. And as a result, you can plug in the address of your property, and it will give an estimated value to your property.
Whether that's an accurate value, well, the market itself will have to figure that out.
No question.
All right. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Let's move on to line one. Caller in Charleston. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning. I have a question on refinancing my house. I need to pay my house before I retire, and I'm thinking about doing that. And I call a bank, and they offer me a percentage rate of 4.75%. The new mortgage will be $826. I'm paying right now $614. So I was wondering if you can give me some information or some advice or opinion on if this would be a good deal.
Let me understand the facts. You currently have a mortgage on your home. Is that correct?
30-year loan, and I need to reduce that debt, so I thought about refinancing the house.
So you're thinking of refinancing the house.
Yeah.
And why are you thinking of refinancing the house?
Why? Because I'm going to retire in the next 5 to 10 years, and I need to get rid of the debt, otherwise I won't have enough money for my retirement. I'm kind of loan my retirement money that I have so far.
So you're thinking of reducing the outstanding mortgage?
Yeah.
And what is the outstanding mortgage currently?
Right now is $54,000.
Okay. And you were going to pay it down to what level?
What do you mean to?
Were you going to refinance your mortgage? That was what you were telling me.
To pay it in less years. 10 years.
Well, now what interest rate do you currently have on your mortgage?
Right now I have 5.87.
5.87.
Yeah.
And is the financial institution willing to loan you $54,000 at 4.75?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And
So I will have to pay more mortgage every month because I'm going to be paid faster. And there is also some closing costs involved, like $2,000.
One of the things that you can do, and this is true under any mortgage that you would have on your personal residence, you probably have something called a 30-year mortgage?
Yes.
Currently. All right.
Yes. Huh?
One of the things that you could do is you could have your accountant or your financial advisor calculate for you, based on your current outstanding mortgage, if you wanted to simply not refinance and simply pay it off over the next 8 or 10 years, what would that mortgage payment look like? That's an alternative, and you should investigate that alternative before you refinance your mortgage and pay $2,000 of closing costs. It may turn out that you are not ahead. So, for example, you could take that $54,000 mortgage, and that's what you're telling me is outstanding right now, approximately?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to do this sort of quickly on a calculator for you. And your current interest rate is 5.87?
Yes.
Okay. And what period of time would you like to pay that off over?
10 years.
Okay, that's 120 payments. Let me tell you what that, basically, that payment would be. That payment would be about $600 a month. Okay, let me do it one more time. If you have $54,000 outstanding, that's the present value, and you want to, at 5.87, let me just do this again to make sure I'm right, because that sounded a little bit low, but I'm not sure.
5.87 is what I'm paying.
Yeah, about $600. In other words, if you made a mortgage payment of $600 a month for the next 10 years on a $54,000 outstanding loan, you would pay it off.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So I really don't need to refinance.
That's my theory. That is exactly what I'm suggesting to you. Because now you have, of course, taxes and real estate taxes on top of it. But I think because you have such a short period of time where you want to pay it off, rather than refinance, simply pay it off over that 10 years and increase your mortgage payment.
Okay.
Okay?
And you save
closing
costs.
and you saved your $2,000 of closing costs. So I think you'll be ahead.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you so much.
All right. We can take more calls at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. In fact, it must be Charleston Day on Focus. Caller on line two. Good morning.
Hi. You often talk about buying stocks. I'm interested in investing in bond funds through Vanguard. Is it a bad time to be putting money into their various intermediate bond funds and the tax-exempt funds, or I also have inflation-protected securities and funds like that?
I think it's a time to go slowly. Very, very slowly. I would certainly couldn't recommend that you suddenly take a large sum of money and put it into bond funds. Now, that's because we have upward pressure on inflation, and ultimately interest rates are going to follow inflation. However, if we read carefully the Federal Reserve comments from last month, even though there is an upward bias on interest rates, it may be many, many months before we see any increase in interest rates in the economy, and that's because of our job market. We just aren't creating enough jobs. So I think if you were going to embark upon this strategy and we were going to look at bond funds, I would certainly use some of the shorter-term bond funds, and I'm not as excited about the tax-exempt funds, to be very honest about it.
Okay.
I think I would probably say with the very short-term corporate bond fund, that's one that you might use.
Yeah, I think I have that.
You have that one, and also the intermediate. Okay?
Yeah.
Those probably would be the two that I would use, but I would probably average in over the next 24 months.
Okay, how about the Ginnie Maes?
And the Ginnie Maes, same thing. Ginnie Maes have held up very well. They've historically done very well. Vanguard runs a very good Ginnie Mae bond fund. I don't really have a problem with it. Again, you are just simply over the next year, 2 years, subjecting yourself to the potential that interest rates are moving up and the value, the net asset value of bonds or the bond funds will move down. So again, I would do this slowly and carefully over at least a 24-month period of time.
How about inflation-protected securities?
I think inflation-protected securities, again, Vanguard has one of the better funds. But right now, even though most of these funds are showing rates of return of anywhere from 2 to 3%, the truth of the matter is that's a very interesting way of reporting the rate of return, and those rates of return are much closer to 0 to 1%.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I would, again, be rather careful, and if you're going to use those four particular funds, which is certainly a reasonable strategy.
Is there any others you'd suggest?
Well, not at Vanguard. I wouldn't go into the long-term fund because I think that has the most interest rate risk. I don't think any of these have a lot of risk over the next 3-6 months, but I think 12, 15, 18 months out there, they have more risk, and as a result, that's why I'm really suggesting that you dollar cost average. Unfortunately, you're in the same boat as everybody else. It's very, very difficult to get any kind of yield on investments today without taking a lot of unnecessary risk. And again, I've countenanced patience and counseled patience for a long period of time, and it's tough to stay patient month after month, year after year, where these interest rates just basically are zero. And again, as I've said on previous programs, what's really happening here is that the federal government is enabling banks to rebuild their balance sheets because they just aren't paying us any money on our deposits.
Yeah, that's the problem because we had CDs come due and no place to put it, the money. Okay, the Vanguard tax-exempt fund, you don't like that municipal bond fund.
Well, it's not that I don't like it. It just has a little bit too long of maturity for my blood. And I think down the road it has a lot of what we call interest rate risk, and that is that the direction of your bond fund is opposite to the direction of interest rates. And if interest rates did suddenly spike up, you could see a 10, 15% drawdown on the net asset value of those bonds.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Okay. Thanks for your call. We'll take more questions for David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance, and our monthly expert on personal finance at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 in a minute. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn incorporates residents' past routines and interests into their daily lives, engaging residents in choices and daily living patterns. More information is available at 384-0100.
This is Focus on Illinois Public Media. I'm Tom Rogers. Our guest, David Sinnoh, professor of finance at the U of I, and your questions on personal finance are welcome at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And we also want to make mention that we don't have the email address available today. We've got a little computer glitch where I can't access email at the moment, but we'll make sure that's not the case next month. And if you have a question, head to the phone instead of the email. Let's take a call on line one in Champaign. Good morning.
Yes, hi.
Hello.
I'm in the process of trying to start a small business. I have some plants that I'm growing in my house, and so I have to register as a small business. I'm wondering, will that affect my taxes for my home?
Well, you're going to – have you registered your small business? Have you filed a fictitious business statement?
Yes, I have done that.
Okay. So basically, you are a sole proprietorship.
Yes.
And you have – and you will be filing a tax return called a Schedule C. And
right.
Unless there is some zoning rule, most people can run a small business out of their homes. And most people don't complain about it unless you are suddenly going to have substantial traffic – showing up at your door, you're running a retail business out of your home. But otherwise, almost always, they do comply with zoning rules. And the question was, is this going to impact – what was your direct question again?
Taxes.
Oh, is it going to – well, it's probably going to positively impact your taxes, because if you have an office in the home and you can consult with your accountant, you will be able to depreciate, if you will, a portion – of your residence, which will give you a tax break. In addition, you will be able to take some of the phone, some of your office supplies, etc., as a tax expense. And there are others as well. So the likelihood is that you're going to get some additional write-off. If you have a mortgage on your home, the area of square footage that you use in your home for your small business, that percentage, you'll also write off the interest on your mortgage. So typically in the early years of a business that you will may even generate a loss, and that will be a dollar-for-dollar subtraction against other income. In addition, in a small business, if you buy something, if you go out and buy computers, for example, buy some type of equipment, at least currently, there are substantial expense rights with those assets. So if you went out and spent $2,000 on a computer, you probably would be able to write that off in the year that you purchased it. You would be able to expense it. But, of course, you would have to have some income to expense it against.
Okay.
All right.
So the bottom line is you probably will have advantages of having that small business in your home, and you'll need to consult with your accountant.
Great.
But you need to get you called it a fictitious business license?
Well, not a fictitious business license. When you start a small business, you file a fictitious business statement.
Okay.
And you have it published
That's a very strange name.
Mm-hmm, and you have it published in your local newspaper, probably, for example, the News Gazette,
like
maybe
legal
the Daily Lining,
yeah. Mm-hmm,
showing that you have started a business. And apparently that gentleman has already done that.
Yes.
But it's fictitious.
Well, do you have a name for your business?
Yes.
All right, that's why. It's not David Sinnoh, it's David Sinnoh doing business as ABC Company.
Okay.
Got it?
All right. Well, thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you for the information. That was great.
Not a problem. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Fictitious, I think, mm-hmm, of something that, you know, the investigators would be called in on.
Oh,
but anyway, let's take a call again in Des Plaines on line four. Good morning.
Good morning, Doctor. I called in earlier
yes.
with my question, and
Sure enough, my wife is listening, and she said, well, what about my question? So here I am asking her question. Could you comment on what makes sense in terms of asset allocation and retirement for conservative people who are more concerned with preservation of capital? And I'll listen into your comments.
Sure. That's a wonderful question. If you're a conservative investor, I still believe that you have to have some exposure, broad exposure to stocks. And as you know, my theory on broad exposure to stocks is owning a portion of all of them, both U.S. and globally. So for that type of asset allocation, I'd be looking at a minimum of 20 to 25% for the most conservative investors in retirement. I frankly feel more comfortable at 30% in the stock market and then 70% in fixed income investments, which of course are money markets, certificates of deposit, etc. They may be bond funds, as we've talked about, but probably generally a 30-70 asset allocation. A lot of people have asked me, what about alternatives? What about, for example, a commodities index? What about a gold index? What about a index of raw materials like lumber, for example, either through a mutual fund or through an ETF, an exchange-traded fund? And my feeling is that if you are going to be involved in alternatives, it should represent no more than 5% of your overall portfolio. And whether that portion of the portfolio goes up or goes down, it's really not that important. Rather, it represents a disaster hedge, if you will. So if suddenly oil goes to $300 a barrel, then you have some type of exposure to oil, which represents a disaster hedge in your portfolio. But so, overall, about 30-70.
So there's going to be some element of conservatism in whatever you do when you're talking about income. You're relying on these investments for income.
No question. And the other possibility with the income side of the portfolio, although it's tough to swallow today, is really what we call a fixed income ladder made up of bonds, certificates of deposit. And that ladder might be today maybe a 3-year ladder where a percentage of your money is in 1-year fixed income, percentage of your money is in 2-year fixed income, a percentage of your money is in 3-year fixed income. It's tough to go out today beyond 3 or 4 years because we feel that maybe 3 or 4 years from now we're going to be looking at a different interest rate climate.
And that could include also, let's say, bond ladder too as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Might include treasuries, it might include corporates, and my only point of caution is to make certain that we buy very high-quality instruments. It's not worth stretching to get a higher yield for lower quality.
Okay, but you don't see, if it were bonds rather than CDs, a bond bubble, do you, Doctor? I mean, from your best judgment.
What I'm talking about in terms of bonds is that you're owning the individual bonds. So if you're going to buy a corporate bond, you're buying a AAA quality corporate bond as part of your bond ladder. Okay? So maybe you have $100,000 in a bond ladder and you own a $10,000 AAA corporate bond, another one that matures in 2 years, it's a AAA corporate bond, another one that matures in 3 years, et cetera. So these you can shop yourself on the internet through your brokerage platform, or if you work with a broker, that they can shop them for you.
Okay, Doctor, that sounds like sound advice, and we'll look into that.
All right.
Thank you for the help.
And thank you for the call again at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Still have about 15 minutes or so or 10 minutes or so to answer your questions about personal finance.
I wanted to go back just for a moment to something that really impacts college graduates. Because we have a lot of them at the University of Illinois. They just graduated, and some of them, as you know, most of them are going back north. They're heading north back to where the jobs are, and there are lots of jobs for young people in the Chicago area. And I get asked all of the time, should I rent or should my parents help me buy? Because prices seem pretty low in the Chicago area.
And interest rates, of course,
are very, very favorable,
And they may have access to, as you mentioned before, the First National Bank of Mom and Dad.
Yes, that's a wonderful institution, and hopefully it will grow and prosper. The question becomes, all right, let me take some time and look around. My personal view is that students who are just graduating, they may not be in the city in 3 years. They're not sure where they're going to be. So I caution them about jumping in immediately and buying a condominium or townhouse, because that's what they're going to do. They're going to live in the city, and you're going to either buy a condominium or townhouse. And there is no shortage of choices. There are well over 10,000 units in the greater Chicago area for sale.
Lots of empty stuff.
So there is no rush to judgment here. And I feel very comfortable that if a student rents for a period of time and is very comfortable in their job, knows that they're going to stay with that company, which is anybody's guess, then, and only then, it makes sense to start looking for a possible purchase. And if you are going to buy a condominium, or if you're going to buy a townhouse, that there are some things that you need to check on with your realtor. First of all, before you even think about making an offer on a condominium or townhouse, you want to examine what are called the CCNRs. Those are called conditions, covenants, and restrictions of record. These are recorded documents that which tells you the do's and don'ts with respect to your condominium and your condominium association. For example, can you rent to someone else
at
your condominium association?
Yeah.
You may or may not be able to rent. Mm-hmm. And very frankly, I probably would not buy as a young person in a condominium facility or building where I couldn't rent my condominium. Can I have pets in my condominium? Are there any contemplated special assessments in my building? If I'm buying in an older building, do the elevators have to be fixed? Does the lobby have to be fixed up? What about the roof, the swimming pool, all of the things? Am I suddenly going to get hammered with a $5,000 or $10,000 special assessment?
Do they have to tell you that in advance?
Well, you can check with the condominium association. You can check with the board of directors to see in the minutes where this has been discussed.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Next, what type of reserve do we have in our association? Do we have $2.50 or do we have $2.5 million in our association to deal with issues? Next, where do I park? Okay, because if I'm going to park outside and I have a nice ride, so to speak, a nice car, guess what? It's going to rust, it's going to get dinged, and hopefully it doesn't get broken into.
I was going to say maybe burglary bait.
Burglary bait.
In
Haven't
Chicago,
heard that term,
especially.
But that, that's definitely a good term. And finally, when I'm looking at a place to live, the number one issue is not price. The number one issue is not what the CCNRs say. The number one issue is safety. Safety. Am I in a safe neighborhood? And more importantly, what does that condominium building look like at night? Because as a young person, I'm going to be working late, and then I'm going to be coming home, parking my car. And what does it look like at night? So I always look at properties at night. They look wonderful in the daytime on a beautiful day where the lake is sparkling and Lake Michigan is sparkling. What do these properties look like at night? So those are just some very, very basic things.
And, of course, that's something you look for with an apartment or whatever you buy.
No question.
It's an interesting point you bring up because, you know, people who are just entering the market are thinking there is no better time than now if you have the wherewithal to buy a property. This is the time to do it. If there's a huge amount, a glut of available housing, and the interest rates are low, and you're able to pay for it, and if you think that the market can't go anywhere but up, or will at least stay stable, why not? But then again, you've got to think about, if it's only going to be for a year, then that may not
can't
be such
out.
A bargain.
Right.
Yeah.
It can't come out. And the other thing you want to be very careful of is when you buy in a large building, you want to know how many of these properties are in foreclosure.
Yeah.
Maybe you've bought one in foreclosure, because here's the bottom line. You get assessed every month, a monthly assessment. And people's properties that are in foreclosure, they don't pay their monthly assessments. That's a big problem. So suddenly the board of directors says, you know, we need a certain amount of money coming in to run this facility. Guess what? Your $200 a month monthly assessment just went up to $300, $350,
no one else is
$400.
Paying it. Yeah.
So this is another issue in these buildings.
It was an article or a story on This American Life not too long ago about one of those types of buildings in Chicago. It was recently done or renovated. It's a really nice place. And then the housing market collapsed and people moved out. And suddenly you've got two or three people who have to shoulder the expense of everything. The place needs a new roof. Then instead of 20 people paying for it, then three people are paying
for
it.
No question about it. Yeah. It's a problem.
333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Room for one or two questions, including this one on line one in Mattoon. Good morning.
Hi. I was listening. I'm in the car. And a while ago they were talking about bonds. And I would like to get the answer to a question that I have, a Vanguard, it's a corporate Vanguard.
Vanguard Short Corporate Bond Fund.
Yeah.
Do you have that fund?
I do.
That's a good fund. You should have done well with that fund.
I have, but all this talk about bonds going down, it has not gone down.
Well, that's because the average maturity and something called the average duration of that particular bond fund is very short. And basically, interest rates really haven't gone up very much. So even if interest rates go up and you're in a very, very short-term bond fund, then your bonds are going to mature rather rapidly. And as a result, they don't fall in value nearly as much as a very long-term bond fund. So one of my favorite funds at Vanguard, if you are going to be in a Vanguard bond fund, is indeed that short-term corporate bond fund. And you have been handsomely rewarded if you've been in that fund for the last several years.
It's called high yield corporate bond. I hope that's the same thing. You know, I'm old and I have Alzheimer's.
Sound pretty sharp.
High yield.
Okay, well, now that's a different fund, and that has done well because interest rates have stayed relatively low. That's has a little lower quality bond in it. And if interest rates did spike up, then the value of those particular bonds would drop.
Yeah.
So now there is another fund.
But we're not anticipating that, are we?
Well, that's anybody's guess, but I don't think next week or next month, certainly.
Okay.
And until we see.
It's been good to me for quite a while.
Okay. Well.
Okay. I appreciate your call, answer to my call.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question. Certainly you'd want to invest in more than just those types of funds, but that's one that's done well.
Right, and diversification pays, and that is to have very, very short-term bonds. You could have intermediate bonds, and you could have long-term bonds. Now, the most famous bond investor, really, of our generation is Bill Gross, and he manages literally billions and billions and billions of dollars of bonds. And even more than that, hundreds of billions of dollars in bonds through the PIMCO funds. He recently sold all of his treasuries, and I believe they have reinvested in corporates, short-term corporates, seeing that there is more value in the corporate side than in the treasury side. That doesn't bode particularly well for you and I as taxpayers and the federal government.
What I was going to ask about, the questions about national debt and all this and how it's affecting treasuries, and a lot of us, carry those as investments.
Well, we do. Keep in mind now that we have theoretically reached our debt ceiling of $14.3 trillion. And one of the reasons that interest rates have stubbornly stayed very low, think about this, if interest rates move up 1%, and we take 1% times $14.3 trillion, that's $143 billion of additional interest that we would owe on all of those financial obligations. That's $143 billion we can't spend on education. We can't spend on infrastructure. We can't spend for poverty-stricken individuals in America. We can't spend on health care. So this is an enormous problem, and again, one of the reasons that we need to get this debt under control.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the scale. $143 billion is the price of a fairly major federal program already. So you're talking about adding on another major program just in debt.
Right. And that's why the Fed has such a difficult issue here, and that's why we do need to get a handle on our national debt, because ultimately when interest rates move up, and nobody will buy our treasuries if interest rates move up unless we offer a reasonable interest rate, it's just terribly harmful, terribly explosive when we are paying so much money out for interest on our national debt. We just can't continue to do that because it crowds out all of our social programs. It crowds out health care. It crowds out Social Security. It crowds out national defense and all of the other things that we need to be doing with our money. It's a terrible problem.
Is there a reason to buy treasuries at this point?
The only reason to hold treasuries is that they are still presumed to be the safest currency in the world. Mm-hmm. Treasuries, you're not holding treasuries for interest unless you are an insurance company, for example, and you own a 30-year treasury instrument, a very long-term treasury instrument. Most of us have treasury money markets or very short-term treasuries. But again, every day with inflation, the purchasing power of that treasury is actually decreasing. So when we get paid back at the end of the day, and we've said, well, the government hands us back our money for our treasury, it's worth less. So it's very, very difficult to make a profound commitment, if you will, to the treasury market. And Bill Gross, obviously, has done just the opposite.
One more thing I just wanted to squeeze in this last minute that we have here, David. Yesterday was a whole bunch of talk about LinkedIn, the latest high-tech company to put out an initial purchase offer. It's soared to well above what it came out in the course of a day, and it's still up there now. What about IPOs for these new companies, and especially the possibility that Facebook could do that? NPR posed the question, is this another tech bubble coming
on? Let's look at things historically. It was supposed to come out at $45. It jumped right out of the gate at $89 or $90, and it's selling over $100. That's about 650 times current earnings. That's too rich for my blood. It's as simple as that. I couldn't recommend in my wildest dreams stepping in at 650 times current earnings. Here is the historical fact. 9 out of every 10 IPOs, you can buy them cheaper a week later. Okay, so let's see where this stock is a week from now, 2 weeks from now. But 9 out of every 10 IPOs, you can buy them cheaper than what they were trading at the first day.
Watch them drop off the headlines and then consider them.
Right? Absolutely.
Well, thanks again for another great round of questions and answers. David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. He'll be back again next month, and we will have the Couch Potato portfolio up online for this month as soon as we possibly can. Thanks again, David.
Tom, it's always a pleasure.
This is Focus.